All right, good morning, everybody.
Good morning.
I'd like to welcome everybody to class. I'd like to welcome those of you who are joining us right now on our live stream. We appreciate you tuning in. I know last Sunday we had some issue with going live to YouTube. So, Eli, would you mind just checking to see if we're live? I'm not sure. The back office to the camera that we use to stream from this classroom made a change last Sunday, and apparently I didn't realize it, and I didn't click the right button. So anyway, if you're joining us live right now, if you're on YouTube, go into the description under the video, and thank you, and you can click on the link for the notes. If you're on Facebook or on the church website, you can go to gracelifebiblechurch.com. You can scroll down under recent sermons, click on the sermon for April 14. And then you can load the notes and follow along with us here as we go through this information. So, just a reminder, we'll have class next week on the 21st, but then on the last Sunday of the month, the 28th, we're not going to have class, and that's because I have to prepare a talk for the pastor's conference in Chicago. So I'll be going Friday, I'll leave Friday, go to that meeting, speak at that meeting early Saturday afternoon, and then drive back. So I'm probably not going to have time to prepare for that and prepare a Sunday school lesson as well. So we won't have class on April 28th. So let's get right into things. This is lesson 232, Assessing the Printed History of the King James Text. And we're going to be looking specifically at 1612 to 1617. Right? So in lesson 229, we began looking at the topic of the printed history of the King James Text by reviewing our earlier comments on this subject in prior lessons. Then in lessons 230 and 231, we explored the which King James Version argument frequently utilized by critics to attack the pro-King James position. And we looked at James White, and we looked at Michael J. Penfold there. We looked at two iterations of that. Lastly, we considered David F. Reagan's response to the which KJV argument as emblematic of a King James-only rebuttal to the argument. While we agreed with much of Reagan's rebuttal, we remain unconvinced that all of the textual changes that occurred between 1611 and 1769 are the correction of printer errors. Okay? Recall that we identified this supposition as requiring further investigation, and it is to that inquiry that we will now turn our attention. So we want to investigate if that's a true statement, that all the changes are printer errors. Okay? So recall that James R. White, Michael J. Penfold, and David F. Reagan all relied upon the work of F.H.A. Scribner from the 1880s to advance their respective positions. None of these men, that would be White, Penfold, or Reagan, none of these men reached their conclusions through their own collation of the various editions of the Authorized Version. More recently, in the last two decades, David Norton and Lawrence M. Vance have sought to update and or build upon the work of Scribner. We will be using these more recent works to frame our discussion of the printed history of the King James, in this section of the class. Now, these works include, so here's the 2005, I have a PDF copy of the 2005 book by David Norton, A Textual History of the King James Bible. I used to have a link to the church, this PDF on the church's website until I got a little email from Cambridge University Press threatening me with copyright violation fines if we did not remove it from the website. So I immediately took it down, okay? And it's not available anywhere on the church's information or on the website or anything like that anymore because it was deemed a copyright violation. But this is the one of the major books that we're talking about here from 2005. The other book is written Lawrence M. Vance. In 2019, started what he thought was going to be a 10-year project, and he was calling it the Text of the King James Bible. And what he did is he sold it chapter by chapter in a spiral binding, and then anybody who bought every chapter would be sent a free copy of the book once it was finalized and published. I have bought and I've purchased every chapter that he has released thus far in that series, and so those two works, A Textual History of the King James Bible by Norton, over my shoulder here, as well as The Text of the King James Bible by Lawrence M. Vance, in my opinion, are representative of the most recent scholarship on this topic that we're discussing here, right? So, having already discussed the first two folio editions, remember we talked about the he-she Bible controversy, okay? Having already discussed that issue of the 1611 and 1612 way back in Lesson 189, Sylvia, make a note that I need to make a link to Lesson 189, please. We will pick up the story of the printed history of the text by examining the King's printer, Robert Barker, and the publication of the first two quarto and octavo-sized editions. So we're going to be looking at this with some level of depth, okay? We're not going to go into every nook and cranny of this, but we're definitely going to be looking at this with a certain level of depth. And the reason we're doing that is this, okay? Of all the topics related to the King James Bible, this topic right here of the printed history of the text, to me, is one of the major underdeveloped subject matters in this discussion, all right? Especially based upon more recent studies that have been done. So point number one, the King's printer at work, 1612 to 1617. Professor David Norton chronicles this history in his book, chapter 4, titled The King's Printer at Work, 1612 to 1617. And he says, beginning in 1612, Barker printed complete King James Bibles in three basic formats: black letter quartos, Roman type quartos, and Roman type octavos. And again, those are the sizes, right? Page for page reprinting was used in each format, so subsequent editions used a predecessor in the same format as the copy text. So you can so what does that mean? That means when he prints a black letter quarto, the next time he prints that, is he going to make reference to the previous black letter quarto that he printed? Okay. This could have led, through reproduction and accumulation of errors, to three separate textual traditions in addition to the text found in the folios. Okay, so let's just stop there. So if you've got a folio in black letter or Gothic font, and then you have a black letter quarto, a Roman type quarto, and a Roman type octavo, that's four different sizes and printings, right? So what could have conceivably happened is you could have developed four different printing traditions, one for each one of those sizes and fonts. Does everybody understand what I'm saying? Okay? But this did not happen. So luckily for us, that didn't happen, in part because the peculiarities of these editions lasted only as long as they continued to be reprinted page for page. Textually, they are dead ends. The relatively few valuable new readings found in them were either transmitted through the folio editions or were recreated in the course of later editorial work. This does not mean that the three editions are valueless. Collectively, they have much to tell us about the King's printer's sense of the text and the way he dealt with corrections. So each time you printed a size in a font, did you run the risk of correcting 10 things and making 6 new errors? You see what I'm saying, right? Because you're laying everything out by hand, right? Each page is typeset by hand. It's when the page is done, it's wiped away and the next page gets typeset, right? So you could conceivably correct 10 things that you know are mistakes and make 6 more mistakes that you're not immediately aware of. So you see the inherent difficulty in this, right? So page 2, quarto and octavo editions. The first topic that Norton covers with respect to the newly sized editions is the introduction of, quote, new readings not found in prior folio editions. And regarding this, he says, quote, a new reading may be surveyed first. A few new readings may be surveyed first. Many of them include the spelling of names and probably have little significance. So is he admitting that a lot of this is just how you spell a name and probably doesn't amount to anything when it comes to meaning, okay? For instance, the first edition has both Galilee, spelled G-A-L-I-L-E-E, and Galilee, spelled G-A-L-I-L-1-E, Galilee, okay? The 1612 editions all leave Galilee with one E unchanged at Mark 15:14, but all change it to Galilee with two E's in Luke 4:44. So that's just a spelling Is that anything of any sort of substantive consequence to meaning or understanding of the Bible? It's just, they fixed it here, they changed it in one spot, they didn't change it in another spot. So there is uneven spelling, is what he's saying, okay? All except one of the octavos make the change at Mark 16:17. But spelling of names can be a ticklish scholarly problem, and some of the 1612 readings may be genuinely scholarly. All the 1612 editions change Imlah, 2 Chronicles 18, verses 7 and 8, to Imlah. So the change there is the double I at the front is dropped, and now there's just going to be one I. Okay, so they changed the spelling with two. So let me just point this out for people who are following online. Okay, this is what we're talking about right here. So this, all the 1612 editions changed this spelling, I-I-M-L-A, 2 Chronicles, to one I at the beginning. Okay, arguably better reflecting the Hebrew. This has become the current King James Bible spelling. So go open your Bible, just turn to 2 Chronicles chapter 18. And what he's saying is that the spelling that was changed there in 1612 became the standard spelling. Okay? So just grab quick 2 Chronicles. Grab 2 Chronicles 18. Excuse me. 2 Chronicles 18. And look at verse 7. And you can see what the spelling is. 2 Chronicles 18, verse 7. And the king of Israel said unto Jehoshaphat, there is yet one man by whom we may inquire of the Lord, but I hate him, and he never prophesied good unto me, but always evil. The same is Micaiah, the son of Imlah. Right? And you notice that the spelling there has how many I's?
One.
Okay? So that spelling got standardized in what edition? One of the 1612 octavos. Okay? So we see that this is the kind of thing that is happening as the text is being printed. Okay? This has become the current spelling, but it comes from the Cambridge 1638 edition. So that tells me that there was still uneven spelling through some of the other editions until it was standardized in 1638, right? Where the change was made again, presumably independently. Similarly, many of the readings that do not involve names are likely to be causal printer variations. Casual. In other words, they're just happening. Not intentionally, but random occurrences, right? But few may be deliberate and scholarly. When he says scholarly, what he means is a change based upon a Hebrew or a Greek word that they think this spelling is a better representation of the word. The 1612 quartos change upon earth to upon the earth in Deuteronomy 4:32. This may be for more normal English, but it could also be a deliberate reflection of the article in the Hebrew. Similarly, all of the octavos change. I don't know why that says changes. One of the octavos changes all people in Psalm 99:2 to all the people, a change reintroduced in 1769. So if you go in your Bible, go just grab Psalm 99. So one of the points I want you to see is that when you start thinking about all these sizes in all of these different prints or fonts, where as this thing gets rolled out, you can see how there's a real chance for things to take a long time to settle in as far as a standard text. Not because anybody's intentionally manipulating it or corrupting it, but because of the nature of printing. Okay? Psalm 99, look at verse 2. And the Lord is great in Zion, and he is high above, notice, all the people. Right? So that becomes the standard reading. Besides, next paragraph, besides these three readings, these editions also have their liberal peppering of errors, some of which are worth recording. Some copies of the first octavo, 1612, read, "Printers have persecuted me," instead of "Princes have persecuted me" at Psalm 119, verse 116. Now, that is itself somewhat humorous, right? Then notice what Norton says. It was tempting to take this as an epigraph for this book. the printers have persecuted me. Okay, one can imagine that a disgruntled compositor made this change, that it was quickly discovered, the compositor dismissed, and the reading corrected in subsequent copies. If some guy's ticked off, could you see him maybe intentionally spelling that word wrong? Yeah, maybe, but that's speculation, right? I mean, and even if he did, it was noticed, and it was what? Fixed, okay? It's kind of funny, though, when you think about what we're talking about, all right? Other errors, such as, "Is there no blame in Gilead," Jeremiah 8:22, 16:13 quarto, and "Darius the Sting," 1 Esdras 4:47 in the 1612 quarto, were more innocent. In other words, they're just simply what?
Errors.
Okay? I do have my wonders about that one, about the printers have persecuted me. That's somewhat funny. Okay? In the next section, Professor Norton addresses instances where the respective smaller editions follow the idiosyncratic readings of the first two folio editions. He says, quote, Herbert's catalog by noting which reading is followed at Ruth 3:15, and sometimes through explicit statements as to which of the first two editions as follows, effectively divides these editions into those that derive from the first and those that derive from the second. Collation with the list of first and second edition variants and with the list of typographical errors in the first edition shows that this is not so. All used the first edition as the base text and added some second edition readings. Collectively, there are some 70 out of the second edition's readings or errors listed in Appendix 2. Now, when he talks about Appendix 2, he has in the back of his book, and you guys will see screenshots of this shortly, there are huge appendixes where, so this is Appendix 2. And what he's doing in Appendix 2 is he's noting variants between the first and the second folio editions for the entire Bible, okay? So Appendix 2 is quite extensive because he has gone through the first edition folio, the second edition folio, he's collated and compared them, and then he's compiled a list of all the differences, okay? So you can see, we don't have time to go through all of this, but if you look at this, most of this is somewhat similar to what we're talking about, right? Issachar, you know, how you going to spell Issachar? You're going to have two S's, you're going to have what? One S, okay? Raph, Roth. Most of this is non-substantive stuff. It's not stuff that's altering the meaning of anything, okay? But I want you to get a sense of the level of depth that Norton went through in doing this, okay? And this is just Appendix 2, all right? We'll be looking at some of his material here in a minute, okay? So where did I leave off? Collectively, there are some 70 out of the second edition's readings or errors listed in Appendix 2. That's this appendix right here. I give these in Appendix 3, dividing them into two groups. We'll look at Appendix 3 in a minute. The first group, consisting of 34 readings, is the most interesting. Though no single edition through to 1617 gives them all, there are grounds for thinking of them as standard corrections. Most of them are still found in modern editions, and all of them, save perhaps the two problems of punctuation at the ends of verses, Luke 1:77 and Philemon verse 4, seem to be deliberate rather than accidental. Of the changes not followed in modern editions, Chaldees, 2 Kings 2:42, regularizes, yes, is that right? A spelling that was later changed consistently to Chaldees with an H, all right? The misplaced dagger, so that would be misnoting a marginal note, the misplaced dagger in Isaiah 10:19 appears to be deliberate, though mistaken, see above page 90, Then he gives an example from the Apocrypha, two examples from the Apocrypha, three examples from the Apocrypha of the same kind of thing. Skip to the next paragraph. There must have been some method of noting these corrections, since they generally go beyond changes that one would expect a sensible compositor to make unaided. So in other words, did somebody have a list somewhere of things that had been noted as errors that needed to be fixed? That seems reasonable, right? They could either have been marked in a master copy of the first edition, or there were a separate list of them that the compositor was expected to refer to as he worked, either from the first edition or from a previous edition in the same format as to the one he was setting. I guess that there was a list and suggested that it consisted of more or less of the 34 entries in the first part of Appendix 3. This might most easily account for the variations between the editions, notably between the editions in the same format. A compositor might well not look at a list at the appropriate moment and so leave unchanged the reading that he should have changed. Now, does everybody understand what he's saying? Now, is he to some degree speculating?
Yeah.
To a degree he's speculating, but do a lot of his speculations make sense as to how these things are happening? Okay? I'm going to skip the parentheses there. Any copy of the first edition might do for setting from if there was a list to amend it by. So setting more than one edition at a time would not be a problem. So he's theorizing that there's a list of things that need to be what? Fixed. Okay? Now, you know how it is. How many times are you aware that you need to do something? You go about doing it and then you forget to go back and do the thing that you knew you were supposed to do. That's what he's saying, that some of these things are the result of those types of human errors. The contents of the... Now let me just stop there, okay? Dave Reed and I are going to be publishing a book. It's coming out before the end of the month, hopefully, right? That book was gone through probably 20 times in the age of word processors, and on the 20th time, minor things were still being found. Now imagine not having the luxury of a word processor where you could, oh yeah, just go in and fix it right away, but you got to do all this by hand. Okay, you can see the problems here that are going to be presented for this type of printing. Okay? Let's see. For example, the incorrectness of the misplaced dagger at Isaiah 10:19 might have been realized after a time, leading to its deletion and possibly even to a note at the printed a note possibly even to a note that a printing from the second edition, such as the 1617 folio, should follow the first edition at this point. Similarly, Shewin at Ruth 3:15 may have been added to the list after the first editions in the smaller formats had been printed. The second group of entries in Appendix 3 is given for completeness. It shows other instances where these editions agree with the second edition. In these two cases, errors are reproduced in a good number of editions. And then he gives a couple there, one in, I'm not sure which Chronicles he's referring to here, but again, you can see that's a spelling issue there. And then more seriously, the Lord was an enemy, for the Lord was as an enemy in Lamentations 2:5. A fully satisfactory account of how all the variants in Appendix 3 were reproduced is probably impossible. But it is worth observing, finally, that the problems of explaining the readings become inseparable. Insuperable, if one supposes that an effort was made to correct the second edition text by the first. Variety would still have to be accounted for, together with a very much larger list of readings reproduced in all editions to 1616 that are particular, sometimes very particular, to the first edition. Appendix 3 of Norton's book is titled The King's Printer's List, in which he states the following. If the King's Printer had a list of changes to be made, so again, he's speculating, okay, to the text of the first edition when using that edition as a copy text for a later setting, It would have contained some or all of the entries given below. The list given here derives from variant readings in the second edition and also found in other earlier settings. A tick indicates that the edition has the change. Pairs of editions in the three smaller formats are given, one of which has he went and the other she went at Ruth 3:15. The 1613 and 1616 folios as independent settings are also given. Finally, though it used the second edition as a copy text, the 1617 folio, the third edition of the large black letter series is included. The 1612 octavos are mixed and sometimes identical. Readings that are found in some copies of the first edition are not identical, are not included. Then he lists those out, and then he talks about an asterisk. So let's look at this table here, okay? Now, first of all, what I want to point out about this is the immense nature of the thoroughness of Norton. Okay? So, 1612 Roman type quarto, 1612 Roman type quarto, 1613 black type quarto, 1613 black letter quarto. Okay? So he's got this down. 1612 octavo, that's what the 8 stands for. 1612 octavo, and then he's got the 1613 folio, the 1616 folio, and the 1617 folio. Okay? So that's, if you count the first two folios, that'd be 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11. He's got 11 editions just on this page, and he's got check marks for which ones change the reading. So, the level of investigation that Norton is going through here is just amazing when you think about the level of depth in what he's doing, okay? So, the top of this, what he is saying are the list of 34 changes. So, let's look at this, okay? So, the first edition had another. A and space other, right? Then it's changed to another, one word, and then he's got a check mark for every addition that includes that what? That change. Okay? So you can track the changes through the list all the way to 1670 using this, right? So we don't have time to look at all of these. Let's just look at a couple more. Exodus 38:11. Hoops. Hooks. And then notice that the adoption of that is uneven through. Right? So do some of these continue to retain hoops instead of the change to hooks? Okay? He went, so this is the famous one at Ruth. The first edition had he went and the changes made to she went. And even that is that unevenly adopted through the first number of printings. And here's another point, right? So you can see that this 1612 quarto, does it have the change, whereas the first one doesn't, nor does the 1613 black letter, the first edition of that does not have the change, but does the second one. So that's what I'm saying, right? That even as you study this out, you can see that the changes that are being made, they are not evenly adopted across the board for all of the subsequent editions. Okay? Now this is, I think, partly why a lot of people don't bother to look at this, because, let's face it, it's somewhat overwhelming and it can be somewhat confusing. But it is important for thoroughness to understand, even if you don't understand every single change, you need to understand the scope of what's going on. Okay? And that a scholar like Norton, has he looked at all of this and charted it out for you? Okay?
Some of these are meanings change the meaning too, didn't they? Because look at the third one now. It says you shall not eat, and the other one says you shall eat.
Yeah.
So change.
So obviously that's a substantive change, but it's an obvious error. Did the printer accidentally insert the word not?
Oh, so the first meanings are the wrong.
So this is the first edition.
Okay.
All right. The first edition has a printer error here by accidentally putting the word what?
No.
It's the same thing as what, I forget the exact year, but there's a famous edition called the Wicked Bible. You heard of the Wicked Bible? What the Wicked Bible does when it's giving the Ten Commandments is it accidentally says, thou shalt commit adultery. Okay? Because they forgot to put what? Not into the verse. Now, that's a printer error, right? I mean, that's an obvious printer error where somebody forgot. I mean, no Bible is ever going to say you should go commit adultery, right? So that's the kind of stuff that we're talking about here when we look at some of this stuff. But even that, ye shall not eat versus ye shall eat. Now notice, that has a mostly even adoption across all the editions except for the octavo editions of 1612. So, that's my point. You have three sizes, folio, the big size, octavo, quarto, but then you have them in Roman type, you have quartos in Roman type, you have quartos in black type, you have octavos, this doesn't actually say, so I'm not sure what typeface this is, and then you've got more folios. So now you're responsible to print all this and to do it accurately before the advent of word processors, and you can understand how this would get this would be difficult to do. So before we move on here, anybody got any comments or questions?
So were there no proofreaders? I mean, if it were me, I would print a page and read it, or have two people read it. It's always better to have a second pair of eyes.
Yeah, there were proofreaders. There were proofreaders, but like, they're human, right? I mean, like, so I don't know how you guys are, but if I'm doing some kind of work that really requires my mental focus, I need it quiet and I need to be by myself, because otherwise I'll be distracted and I'm not able to focus. So now imagine you're setting all this type in a print shop with all who knows what kind of noise and commotion is going on, and you have to accurately composite the text and the proofreader has to read it. Like, I am really honestly saying to you that I'm surprised they didn't make more mistakes than they actually did. And imagine you get all the way down to the end. And by the way, if my memory is right, aren't you like setting all this type backwards?
Yeah.
In the tray? Okay, so you're setting all the type backwards in the tray. What if you make a mistake way at the bottom? Or you realize you got the whole thing done and you realize way at the top there's a mistake. You gonna clear that whole page and start over? I mean you could see where somebody's like, yeah, I think I'm gonna let that one ride. I mean, I'm not saying that they were that flippant about it, but you could see where that kind of a thing would happen, right? Any other comments or questions before we move on?
Big the buildings were
that
they stored all
that.
Oh, yeah.
In Ruth, where it says he went, she went, was that a typo? Because there's a difference between he and she.
Yeah, because that's the story. We've looked at that one before, but go there quick. Go to Ruth 3. This is arguably the most famous one, because it literally delineates between what people believe is the first and the second edition, right? Ruth, was it 3:15, right?
Yep.
So look at Ruth 3, verse 14. And she lay at his feet until the morning, and she rose up before one could know another. And he said, let it not be known that a woman came into the floor. So he's talking about the threshing floor. And he said, bring the veil that thou hast upon thee and hold it. And when she held it, he measured 6 measures of barley and laid it on her, and she went into the city. So if it's she, who's going into the city? Ruth. Look at the next verse. And when she came to her mother-in-law, she said, Who art thou, my daughter? And she told her all that the man had done. Okay? So, it's a typo. It gets caught and it gets fixed. Okay? Now, I'm not going to go through. I would suggest to all of you, if you're interested, that you should read the fine print here on Norton's appendix here and kind of go through this, because, you know, this does get into some things. Now, here we have much more uneven examples, right, where you have changes being made that are taking a while to show up in the various printings and editions, okay, that are not adopted, shall I say, as fast as some of the other ones. Now, again, we don't have time to look at every single one of these, right? But I did want to give you all this information so that you had this scope in your thinking as a frame of reference for what's going on here. Okay. Now, before we move on, does anybody have any questions, Amy?
So on the Leviticus 17:14, you shall not eat, those changed to you shall eat. So did they have to look at the context to know that that was an error there, or it should be you shall eat?
So let's go look at that. What verse is it?
Leviticus 17:14.
17:14. So, yeah, so let's 17:14. So in the context here, he's talking about the sanctity of blood, sacrifices, etc. Verse 14. For it is the life of all flesh, the blood of it is for the life thereof. Therefore, eat the blood of no manner of flesh, for the life of all flesh is in the blood thereof. Whosoever eateth it shall be what? So the variant is ye shall not what? So that's the first edition has what?
Not eat.
Not eat. So if you look at the verse, so it's that first ye. So let's read the verse again. Verse 14. For it is the life of all flesh, referring to blood. The blood of it is for the life thereof. Therefore I say unto the children of Israel, ye shall eat the blood of no manner of flesh. It would be a double negative if you insert the not in there. Okay? So some of the changes, Amy, to your question are apparent by just reading English and knowing that can't be right because it doesn't make sense. Some of them may have required some scholarly knowledge of the Hebrew and Greek to be able to identify a change that needed to be made because the printer made a mistake. So you have both things happening, and that's Norton's point. Some of them are obvious just by reading the English, and someone along the way would have had to point out an error based upon an underlying language issue. Okay, AJ?
Knowing that the Jewish people had such a rich history, even to today, of their oral history, I mean, one of the historians I heard doing a speech was, and he himself grew up among many Jewish people, they memorized just through back and forth and constant repeatings. Didn't these educated people at some point say, hey, let's go get some Jewish rabbis or some Jews that this is their life, and at least we've got this much that we can say, translate that. You know what I mean?
I don't think that would have mattered for typesetting an English Bible.
But in the actual translation and then doing proofreading, I would think that you would still want to have someone who...
If that happened, there's no record of that happening, and I would say that the translators themselves ferreted all that work out in whatever they gave the printer. But see, that's the thing, right? That's the other issue here is we don't know for sure. So imagine, I'm giving you an illustration here, okay? So imagine I'm the King James translators, and I'm done. And I say, here you go, printer. We don't know for sure what those guys handed the printer. That has not survived history. Okay? So now the printer, who did, was not a translator, he's just tasked with the job of executing the printing, is going to impact the text in ways that the translators would not have intended. Those are clearly printer errors. Okay? Does that help?
Yeah.
So I don't think they're going to have any Hebrew scholars, other than possibly translators who may have been involved in some of that stuff, catching some of those errors that may have been scholarly errors, not of their doing, but of the printer's making. Okay? Does that make sense? Anybody else got a question? Okay.
You can see how that happened with "ye shall eat and or not eat." If you just read the first half of the sentence, "ye shall eat the blood," obviously that's not. And you have to read the whole sentence to get the
right.
The double negative there.
Right. So obviously there's a problem there. The whole thing with, you know, he, she, she's talking about, I moved off it, but you're talking about the difference of one letter. Right?
And you're talking about a dialogue between a man and a woman.
Right. In a context, there's something going on between both of them, right? So, no, she, I think she is the right reading. Okay? But, any other questions? All right, let's go to the bottom of page 5. So I commend all this other stuff to you to check it out. Especially those of you that are online are going to have time to sit down and read this. But I really want you to see the depth of Norton's work. Okay? Bottom of page 5, he starts talking about the 1613 folio. Okay? Now, this is an important edition. In 1613, saw the publication of a smaller folio size. So it's still the same size dimensions. It's smaller in the sense that the number of leaves goes from 732 to 508. By getting 72 lines per page instead of 52. So they use a smaller typeface so they can get more lines on a page and therefore utilize fewer what? Pages to make it smaller. Well, you understand. If it's smaller, is it going to be cheaper to buy? Because you're not using as much material. So the intention here is to make a smaller size folio with more lines of text per page with fewer pages to make it cheaper to buy. And remember our previous discussion. One of the issues was some of these parishes possibly did not have the money to buy the big folio Bible, right? Well, now they're addressing that to some degree by making a smaller size. Okay? But the problem here is, as soon as you do that, are you now running the risk of introducing a whole other set of printer errors. Okay? So the 1614 folio is a smaller black letter and no doubt was designed as a cheaper alternative for poorer churches. By getting 72 lines to the page instead of 52 and more characters to a line, it reduced the number of leaves from 732 to 508. So it's going to be smaller as far as thickness. Okay? Textual historians such as Scrivener and Norton described the 1613 folio as, quote, handsome but inaccurate. So we need a parenthesis or a quotation mark after inaccurate. Textually, it is of no more importance than the contemporaries in the smaller formats. But as the first folio in a new format, it is worth some examination. It introduces four readings that have become standard, okay? That ye may have, for that he may have, at Ezekiel 6:8. She poured it not, for she poured it, Ezekiel 24:7. As a flower, for as flower, at 2 Esdras. And what thy right hath done, for what thy right doeth, in Matthew 6:23. We can strike that number 12 there as well, Sylvia. The first three of these correct mistakes, while the last is unnecessary and goes against the evidence of Bod 1602, where what thy right doeth is left unchanged. It also introduces seven accepted spellings of names. Finally, it has fleshly for fleshy. Okay, at 2 Corinthians chapter 3, verse 3. A reading that has had a long life and is still occasionally to be found. Nearly all of the other variants, writes Scribner, arise from the glaring misprints of this handsome but inaccurate volume. You can strike the 13 there as well, please. This is right. The 1613 folio is another characteristic piece of Barker's work. A copy from earlier work that introduces its fair share of errors, but has little or nothing in that it goes back to the translator's manuscript or reflects scholarly revision. Variants in Genesis confirm the tendency to error. So, if we look at this, here's what we're talking about. So, the 1611 folio, and shall cleave, 1613 folio, and cleave. It leaves out what? Shall. These are all from Genesis, right? Yeah. Genesis 3:5, day ye eat thereof, then your, day when ye eat thereof, your. So what are we talking about here? Just then, right?
When and then.
Yeah, so we got changes there. Upward for upwards. So here's the 1611, here's what happens in the 1613 folio. Okay? So, again, I don't think that I have to go through every example here. Genesis 22:13, Abram lift. Well, that doesn't even make sense, so obviously is that a mistake? Okay. So in this case, did the 1611 get it right, and is this one erring? So now there's a new printer error introduced. Okay. So bottom page 6. The 1613 folio took the first edition for a copy at least through the end of Judges. In this part, it occasionally reproduces errors that are particular to the first edition at Genesis 17:14. You have the double vertical lines for the dagger, as the marginal reference omitted, so that's a mistake, and it coincides with the second edition only 5 times, 4 of which appear to be standard corrections. Ruth to 1 Kings looks more likely to have been set from the second edition, as does much of the books of Chronicles. The end of 2 Chronicles through Esther appears to follow the first edition, Job the second, and Psalms to Proverbs the first. Song of Solomon to Isaiah probably follow the second. Then the first edition is followed through the end of the Apocrypha. Matthew follows the second edition, Mark to Acts the first, and thereafter the second may possibly have been used. So he's just trying to, you know, chronicle all of this. Okay, let me just check on something here, because there's another lengthy. Okay, besides the information in Appendix 4, these observations are supported by the occasional reproduction of errors, such as the first edition's double vertical lines for the dagger at Ezra 8:17, and fenced, right? Fenced? At Psalm 31:21. The second edition's to see which the vine flourished for to see whether at Song of Solomon 6:11. And so you can kind of go through there and read all that. I think for the sake of time, I'm going to skip that and go to the bottom of the page. Okay? Well, go to the next. Go to occasionally. Occasionally, one might argue that 16 folio picks and chooses between the first two editions, but generally it is indiscriminate, using one or other edition as a copy for stretches at a time. So in other words, it'll pick one, it'll go with it for 5-6 books, and then it'll go to the next one. That probably has to do with who's typesetting it, would be my guess. Okay? This suggests that there was now no single copy identified as the master, and that Barker's workers had little sense of the difference between the first two folios. Careful comparison would have been needed to distinguish a first edition from a second edition. The modern scholar knows to look at Ruth 3:15, but did Barker's men know this? It is quite possible that a compositor beginning his day's work sometimes picked up a first edition and sometimes a second edition to work from. Similar suppositions might be made if the work was subdivided among compositors, that's what I just said, or even sometimes contracted out. One large folio, it seems, was as good as another, If so, it is more a matter of chance than policy that the editions in the smaller formats followed the first edition, and it will be no surprise to find that the latter editions appear random in their textual allegiances. Professor Norton addresses the 1613 folio more thoroughly in Appendix 4, titled Selective Collation of the 1613 Folio with the First and Second Editions. The explanation of Appendix 4 reads as follows. Quote, the purpose of this collation is to show where the 1613 folio appears to use the first edition and the second edition as copy text. Readings from the first edition are aligned left. Those from the second edition are aligned right. The following four groups of readings have been omitted because they probably do not give a clear indication as to which edition is being used as the copy text. Number one, errors one would expect a compositor to correct. Number two, readings found in some copies of the first edition and in the second edition, except for Exodus 21:26, which in combination with verse 27 constitutes a distinctive first edition reading. Number three, readings that are found in the first edition and some but not all copies of the second edition. And number four, readings from my hypothetical King's printer list, since these may be deliberate changes to the text. Okay, so now let's look at the appendix. So again, this I'm trying to give you a sense of this without... So let's just look at this, okay? So anything that is left justified indicates that the 1613 folio is following the first edition. Anything that is right justified, like over here, indicates a place where it is following the second edition. Okay? So you can scroll through this and you can see that what Norton is doing is he's trying to be specific as to where a given reading is coming from. So let's just focus in on this part right here. So this would be what book? So this is First Chronicles. It's in First Chronicles. So notice this column here, if it's left justified like these two at chapter 7 verse 38 and chapter 21, this is related, S I think is related to a what's the word I want?
You don't know.
Yeah, you don't know, do you? S, I think, is related to a cross-reference. Okay? But notice, if it's a left justified, that means this is a case where the 1613 folio was following the first edition. When it's right justified, it means it's following what? The second edition. And you can turn the pages in your notes. Page 8, page 9, page 10, okay, all page 11, all of that is his collation. So, again, it is my opinion that anyone that is simply relying on Scribner is not relying on the latest information. Norton's work here is exceedingly thorough, and he found stuff that Scribner didn't find. Okay? So, we can go all the way then to page 12.
And this didn't include apocryphal books.
It did, because they were in this, they were in these folios. Conclusion. In the next lesson, we will round out our discussion of the King's, our discussion of the activity of the King's printer between 1612 and 1617 by looking at the following editions. Okay, now, to as if it weren't complicated enough, in 1616, he does another small folio, this time in Roman type. So it's in a different type than the one we just talked about from 1613. And then the 1617 folio would be the last one that we need to look at. By 1617, I would say there was a certain amount of standardization that had occurred. But there's going to be editions that we're going to study in 1629 and 1638 that are really going to make advances in trying to standardize some things. Okay, so any questions about lesson 232?
No questions, but I think when they were printing this out, you know, when you got all the letters and everything, I think they had back then. can't find glass.
Well, that's kind of a comment I want to make, because when you look around the room, we're all wearing glasses. And he's had glasses all his life, but I didn't get mine until 40.
Lisa's not.
Well, have for reading.
Well, you need for to read.
That's the point, right?
But so I don't know, you know, how many hundreds of years ago if people's eyes were any different back then than they are now. I mean, it's most people wear glasses. I mean, it's just
so. That's what I'm saying. They had. I mean, I'm sure there's magnifying glasses long before, and I know they had to have that because there's no human eye that can take all those letters and keep doing it
backwards.
They cannot do it. They had to have a magnifying glass.
Yeah, I think there are any number of innocent human error explanations for why this is happening the way it is that do not involve malicious printing. Now, the one about printer, the one about what did it say? Printers have persecuted me. That one, you know, maybe somebody did that on purpose. It's a little bit funny, you know, to think about somebody doing that. I mean, you just insert that in there and you can, anyway. But most of this is totally innocent types of mistakes that are being made that are not going to be easily found for the variety of reasons that you guys have identified, right? Busy printing houses, backwards proofreading of the text as it's laid out on the page, you know, poor eyesight, maybe poor lighting in the, you know, there's, you know, any number of things.
I think I seen a jeweler a long time ago. He had a thing that hooked to his glasses, and it was a magnifying glass. I mean, to me, I think that would be very uncomfortable, but that's what I think. They either have that.
I don't think they had one more glass.
They were clearly all wearing monocles like the Monopoly guy.
they were wearing something, or they used something, because they could not do this.
So
I thought it was Ben Franklin that developed the eyeglasses.
I think he developed them for, like, we know them now, but I think they had magnification type glass, you know, like, that you could have used before that. I don't know the history of magnifying glasses, but I'm just, seems plausible, okay? So,
did they use them?
Well, how many of those printers, much less the people who did the interpretation originally, how many were sucking down the king's wine? I mean, at some point you got to figure there's more than just one issue.
Oh, there's multiple issues that could have resulted in this type of thing, because, like I said, even what goes on in here, I've used this as an example before, right? So I type the notes, okay? I send them to Mike and Sylvia on Friday. Mike and Sylvia go through them once, right? We teach them out loud. I go through the notes. Do we find more things almost every week that still need to be fixed, right? Then when it comes to me printing these, I send them to Amy. Amy goes through them again and finds more stuff. Okay? Then we get the thing laid out in the book, and we get the actual book format, and then I have somebody look at it again and they find more stuff. And this is in the modern age using word processors. You know, and none of the people that I have look at stuff, I think, are, you know, hitting the sauce and then reading the notes. Okay? And they're not using magnifying glasses, and it's still just the way of things. I'm telling you, printing a book, publishing a book is one of the most tedious, annoying things that you can do, probably.
And your mind corrects it as you're reading.
And yes, I can't find that, and that's the other thing. Thank you for saying that, Bart. When I read my own stuff, I get to a point where I can't see my own mistakes because my mind automatically fills in the blanks of what I knew I meant to say, even if that's not what the line actually says. So I'm terrible at proofreading my own stuff because I read it the way that I... Anyway, I'm complaining, and that's not what we want to do, but we do need to quit. So next Sunday we'll have class. We'll look at some more things, then we'll take